And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
I'm sorry, you can sit there and look and play with all your silly machines as much as you like.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant!
He's round the goalkeeper, he's done it! Absolutely incredible!
He launched himself 6 feet into the crowd and Kung Fu kicked a supporter who was without a shadow of a doubt giving him lip.
Oh, I say, it's amazing.
He does it tame and tame and tame again.
Crank up the music, charge your glass. This nation is going to dance all night.
The cruel online language of the nutmeg. The one in a million moment of touching a match ball in the stands. The unique texture of a pre-match cheeseburger. The official hierarchy of the most annoying types of unsuccessful corner taking. Immobile quadragenarian goalkeepers. And biased co-commentators. Brought to your ears by The Athletic. This is Football Clichés. Hello everyone and welcome to episode 103 of the Football Clichés podcast. I'm Adam Hurry and with me yet again is Charlie Eccleshare. How are you doing?
I'm good, how are you?
No, not too bad. A little bit on edge actually, because had an email from listener P. Drury this week regarding our chat about re-recorded commentary the other day.
Oh, wow.
He says, I thought you and your guests would be interested to know that my version of the 1998 Dennis Bergkamp goal versus Argentina was absolutely authentic, live, in the moment, and at the stadium. I was there a few seats away from Barry Davis on a beautiful day in Marseille. The BBC had the game live. My version was on the ITV highlights later that day. I am mortified. That's me at the end.
That's great that he's listening for a start. I'm just really pleased about that, to be honest. The rest of the stuff, I'll get over that we got that wrong. Apologies though, Peter. That's poor on our part.
It is poor. I am truly ashamed. He took it in incredibly good humour. But I'd like to state my public and sincere apologies. Please don't stop binge listening to Football Cliché, Drury. But yeah, glad to smooth that one over. But today it's all about our guest, the Mesut Haaland-Dix. He's an actor, narrator, and the man whose voice alone has sold 14,961 Dasha Sanderos in the month of August 2021, according to data from 26 European markets collected by Jato Dynamics, and former The Office ace, it's Ralph Ineson. How are you?
I'm very impressed with that Dasha stat.
I do my research, as has been sort of established on this podcast so far. It got me thinking, I'm so obsessed with Dasha Sanderos now, thanks to your voice, that all I can think about at this stage is, if Dasha Sandero was a footballer, what would he be like? I mean, it's a very footballery kind of name.
Oh, I remember recently Leeds were in for Rodrigo De Paul from Udinese for ages, and there was all sorts of weird social media stuff about it. And he was, Udinese was playing with a Dasha emblazoned shirt. And so I don't know, that kind of stuck in my mind, but I think I might really be doing the very fine footballer Rodrigo De Paul a slight disservice if I
really
not just Andero. You know,
you can't say that.
Well, you know, I think they're a solid buy and good value, but I don't think they're quite international Juventus level.
Charlie, I can absolutely imagine, I don't know, Rob Hawthorne exclaiming that those two words as a shot whistles just over the bar as Watford make a bright start at home to Southampton. It's pulled back and Dasha Sandero!
Dasha Sandero, a winger, a kind of doesn't really ever score or assist, but kind of looks vaguely dangerous.
Yeah.
As you say, enough to earn that move to Watford.
Yeah, socks definitely down, that's for sure. That would have been worlds colliding for you there, Ralph. But you go very Leeds, let's face it. am I right in saying you have a dog called Grayson?
I have three dogs, yes. Grayson was named after, at the time I got him, was the last manager to get us promoted. So, yeah.
Okay.
Got, and it also suited him because he's a Great Dane. Kind of the name worked. I've also got a female Great Dane called Rini, named after Paul Rini.
Oh, okay.
And my French bulldog is called the Don, after Don Revy.
Yeah, we're covering all the decades here. This is great.
Okay. And I've also had Labradors named after Eddie Gray and Billy Bremner. Yes, there's a theme somewhere.
How okay. close is Bielsa to reaching that pantheon?
Yeah, you see.
What does he have to do?
For my 50th birthday, my wife bought me a statue of a Great Dane, and that is called Marcelo. I don't ever want to lose Marcelo.
Maybe if he keeps his win percentage over Simon Grayson's 49.7, he's in with a chance. Let's hope so. But I'll keep my eye on that one. I mean, of course, you did the audiobook for Phil Hayes' Bielsa opus, and it was beautiful.
Yeah.
That can't have been an unenjoyable voice gig for you.
No, it was one of those, yeah, like, really, I'm getting paid to do this. it's a really good book as well. So, yeah, absolutely. Thoroughly enjoyed
it. And now you're Mesut Harland-Dix.
Yes.
Astonishing.
Oh my God.
So, yes, Mesut Harland-Dix indeed. Let's get rolling. Ralph, tell us about your first love of football.
So the first one is nutmegs. Just such a simple part of the game, but there's so much humour and cruelty and beauty in it. I've been very spoilt as a Leeds fan over the last few seasons. Having Pablo Hernandez in the Championship was just, you know, averaging 3 or 4 nutmegs every game. It was just hilarious. It was wonderful to watch. And now, obviously, we've got Rafinha, who's not making people for fun as well. So, yeah, just a simple pleasure that I just love.
I mean, this is obviously quite a universal joy for football fans, but I feel like it's more of a kind of televisual thing, Charlie. I feel like TV does a really good job at ramming home the effect of a nutmeg. I mean, I think in person, people perhaps in a stadium, perhaps in the flesh, you don't kind of appreciate it as much.
That maybe because they're missed, aren't they, sometimes? Whereas, I mean, there was the whole Soccer AM nuts and megs, I want to say campaign, that's maybe overstating it, but I feel like they really went to town on nutmegs. And I remember at my school, and I don't know how universal this is as a game, was Nutmeg Rush, where you just had everyone on the pitch and you just tried to nutmeg each other, and if you got nutmegged, you got beat from everyone else, basically. And it was very enjoyable, a certainly more violent celebration of the nutmeg, but nonetheless sort of testament to its enduring popularity.
Yeah, unnecessary layer of pain there. But Ralph, I guess the core appeal of this is that it's equally distributed between the player who performs the nutmeg and the victim of the nutmeg itself.
Absolutely.
There's so much to play with.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd slightly disagree with the televisual thing. I mean, they do a great job by actually getting the reaction of the player who's just been done and all of that, which does it. Yeah, but what you don't really get is the laughter of the home crowd when the home player, not my home player, just that's what I love about it. The fact that everybody finds it hilarious. It's a real happy cheer. It's not an angry. It's not like a 50-50, you know, when you're going for 50-50 challenge or something. That's a very different kind of cheer. But a cheer for a nutmeg, that wee is a joyous thing.
To pick up on that point you just made about the sight of a player who's just been done by a nutmeg. Now, again, not very podcast friendly this, Charlie, but there is a very specific body language of a player who's just been nutmegged. It's kind of, they stand up really straight.
Yeah, I think the head goes back. In a kind of,
it's just a universal symbol for, there's nothing I could have done about that.
There's a great one of Lamella, I think it's on Andros Townsend, and Danny Rose is in the background, just like, cannot believe what's happened, as Townsend kind of lollops his head back and just like, oh, this is so humiliating.
I do kind of feel that the English obsession with nutmegs in particular has been quite a latter-day thing. Ralph, and what's come with it, certainly in the last few years, is a really kind of bizarrely cruel sub-language that has developed mainly via Twitter. And thanks to Ollie Quinn Palmer for giving us a handy list of things that kind of signify this. Exclamations like, that defender has a family!
Stop it, he's already dead. These kind of
There's an element of tweeness about it, Charlie.
Yeah, that has very much taken. I mean, the whole thing, like, you've been owned, or that internet word PWNED, which can't really be said in real life. I mean, it's
definitely not.
It's it's all just, it's very, I guess it is, it does lend itself to social media for those little clips, because there is that inherent humiliation. And it's just really funny when it happens to someone. And there are some players, I'm sure, Ralph, you've had it as well. Like, if there are players that are particularly unpopular at ground for whatever reason, them being nutmegged is just about the sweetest thing that can happen.
Yeah. Yeah, that kind of cruelty. Similar level. I remember Leeds playing at Sellers Park years ago when Rowland was playing for Sellers Park. And he was running around like a nutter because he was getting absolute pelters from the Leeds fans, obviously. So he was doing that kind of thing where he's just trying far too hard. And he cut his head open, which in itself is funny. Comes out with a big bandage, which is very funny. And then it was topped by the fact that he took a ball to the head, which knocked the bandage off. By that point, the whole away end was just dead. It's just like, it can't get any better than that. But it's generally kind of that kind of ritual humiliation side of the nutmeg was what reminded me of that.
Well, I've just realised, of course, that it's kind of a snowball effect, because the more angry that the potential nutmeggy gets, and the harder he tries to stop being nutmegged, the easier and more likely it is that he will be nutmegged, because he's committing too much to it. So it really is a gift that increasingly keeps giving.
Do you have a threshold, Ralph? Like, is there a point at which you... Because there are some players who you do feel are looking for nutmegs, even if it's really getting them absolutely nowhere. Do you mind that, as long as if they get that moment of nutmeg them? Or do you feel like it has to actually have a purpose, or it doesn't really count?
Oh, I think it's got to have a purpose. I mean, that purpose might be humiliation. as long as he's kind of thought about it, not just someone who's just like throwing out tricks just for the funk of it. But actually, if you think, right, I'm going to actually humiliate now so you can't play for the rest of the game, that is a positive version of a nutmeg, I would try. And it was also that it also spreads to the great joy of a defender being tied up in knots to the point where he actually falls on his arse. That again is taking this to going back to Rafinha, who was playing earlier on in this international break. I think it was against Colombia, and he did this thing. He turned the defender in knots, and actually did. He didn't even fall on his arse. He tried to turn and tied his legs in knots and fell over. It was just a thing of comic beauty.
Well, it's always a great sight, Charlie, when, as we often say on this podcast, when elite level footballers are made to look like rank amateurs, and there is no finer example.
I mean, that's like the Messi, it's Boateng, isn't it?
Yeah.
I always think of that one, because that's like an absolutely elite defender, as you're saying, being made to look so amateurish that he can barely kind of, he's so Bambi on ice that it does just give you a sense of how amazing these attacking players must be for them to look that stupid.
These things can go too far, though. Because, Charlie, of course, you'll be fully familiar with the Copa Iberoamericano of 1994. Yeah, exactly. Boca Juniors played Real Madrid. And Robert Prosinecki produced a pirouette so successful, so slick, that Boca Juniors defender Julio Saldana was ruled out for an entire year with ruptured knee ligaments. It's beyond the threshold for Ralph's enjoyment.
Yeah, that's a bit far even for me, I think.
There's footage of it, really, really, you know, reassuringly grainy footage from 1994, and it looks just awful. It's so devoid of dignity for the entire passage.
That is one where you genuinely do feel for their family all of that, because poor, I mean, that's just so brutal.
Actually, this is a good point. Maybe, so that defender has a family actually does work in this one. Stop it, Prosinecki, presumably does work. Don't do that again. You're hurting people. Yeah, maybe these Twitter lines do work. So, yeah, life
affirming. Wasn't there, because didn't Neymar get booked when he was still playing in Brazil for like ungentlemanly conduct for just doing too many skills and making defenders look really, really stupid?
Yeah, but I don't think a nutmeg could ever do that, because I don't think that would ever become kind of superfluous to a game, because it's quite a useful thing to do. So I don't think you ever get booked for a nutmeg. Ever happened, that would be sensational. But speaking of life affirming, Ralph, tell us about your second love of football.
Getting to touch the match ball during play. not like kind of before anything, but when it comes into the crowd.
Right.
Yeah, just a couple of times. Whenever you see it, if you just look at the joy on anybody's face, whenever they're the one who gets to batter the ball back into play, you know, whatever age kind of person they are, there is just a deep joy and feeling that today is a very special day.
Has it ever happened to you?
It did. I was at college in Lancaster. And so in times of no money, we used to go to what's Lancaster City. At the stadium was called the Giant Axe Stadium.
Giant Axe?
Giant Axe Stadium. They were known as the Axemen.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, it was brilliant. But it wasn't, it was a really terrible little stadium. But we had a lot of good fun. And one game was against Farsley Celtic. Mm-hmm. The ball comes flying, missed the goal by a mile. I jumped up like a salmon above my friends and pulled out the perfect keeper from a corner punch. Punched the ball straight back into the hands of the keeper who was waiting to take the goal kick. He gave me a nod, thumbs up, and a bit of a respectful nod. And yeah, I don't think I've ever felt so cool in my life.
I am. My heart is swelling at this story, just for the entire scene of this. But I, two red flags here, Charlie, that I feel like we need to address. First of all, Ralph elected to punch.
That's incredible.
Didn't catch it. Punched it, which is incredibly continental. I mean, this was years before he became a, you know, a worldwide star. Getting ideas way above his station here.
Setting that trend.
Yeah, so like 1989, yeah. I've been watching far too much Channel 4 football at the time with James Richardson and his little thing.
Did you not fancy heading it either?
No, I actually was. Well, I identified as a keeper. I wasn't saying I was a keeper, but that was the position I played. So it was a natural thing for me to do.
Mm. You come across so centre-halfy. I'm surprised.
That has been said before.
A rugged centre half.
If I was casting any sort of film that involved a football team, you would be my number five.
Yeah.
Been around the block.
I went to about 2003 or four when I was still young enough to look like I could play football. I played in a pre-season kind of celebs and legends against the team against Leeds United at Ellen Road on the pitch.
Oh, nice.
I'll never forget walking into the dressing room and they all kind of turned around. All the rest of the team were like, excellent. Boom, as I walked in, and I was just thinking, oh, you poor bastards. No idea how shit I am, but I kind of thought, yeah, I probably do actually look the part. Yeah, that's fine. I can get how you go, yeah, brilliant. I've seen that I'm really rubbish at football. Disappointment I was about to unleash on them was quite poignant.
This story, however, is rescued by the final twist of this kind of brief interaction between you and an actual footballer.
Yeah.
I just feel like in these situations and other ones, you know, be it abuse or adoration, I don't think anybody is really prepared for a one-to-one interaction with a footballer because, you know, you have mass booing and worse often. But, you know, a one-to-one interaction with a footballer, I don't think anyone is really kind of prepared for that moment.
No.
Especially elite level.
Elite level, like Lancaster City versus Hardly Celtic. Yeah.
With a celeb like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was. It was very Buffon-esque.
Yes. Oh, what a lovely way of describing it. Charlie, we asked our listeners for their experiences of touching the match ball in various contexts. Mike Bailey says, I was photographing a game at Crooktown FC when the ball bounced over the perimeter wall onto the terrace. Camera in hand, I effortlessly flicked it back onto the pitch with my heel. A group of home fans started singing, sign him up. Excellent.
Mm-hmm, nice.
To date, my proudest achievement in life. As a cameraman, that's pretty impressive. I mean, already focusing on something else, quite literally.
I have to say, I've been going to football probably like 25 years and I've never touched the match ball. And I kind of want it to stay that way. It feels almost like the Holy Grail that it's like, will this ever happen?
Twice.
And really, twice. Yeah. Twice. But I remember when I started going to football, it was such a big talking point. It was like, do you reckon you'll touch the ball? It's like, I don't know, but a friend of mine, he was like two rows away from touching the ball.
Like, it's like winning the lottery. It's literally like winning the lottery. Yeah, you could be like one number away.
Go on then, what were your two...
Scared of what might happen after that. Exactly, the rest of your life will be meaningless.
Exactly, that's the thing. Yeah. It's just going to frazzle my brain too much. Like, once you have that celebrity... Very tough.
I'd never want to come close to heading it. I'd either want it never to happen to me, even slightly, or I'd want full contact. I don't want to be flirting with it. I really enjoy this one. This is from Tom Wooders. Once had the ball kicked into the stands at the Amex when I was right by the pitch. One bloke headed it towards me and I caught it to big cheers from everyone around me. I felt like a goalkeeper whose defender had just headed it back to him. That takes some coordination. That's another layer, isn't it?
Impressive.
Very impressed. But these things do take a turn for the worse. Trail of debt. Says, I sat with my feet up at Boston when the ball came my way. Hands were in my pocket, so I stuck a foot out and accidentally diverted the ball into a face of a bloke nearby. He fell out of his seat moaning in pain, bloodied nose streaming, and had to be taken away by paramedics. Grimace emoji. What's the etiquette there, Ralph? I don't know what to do.
Yeah, I mean, it's an assist rather than a direct assault, isn't it? You know what I mean? He's not actually kicked the bloke in the face, but hands in pockets, but you could still get your foot out.
The implication there was that he just stayed in his seat and didn't go with the bloke.
Yeah.
I don't know. If you don't know him, I guess that would be even weirder. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I just like the idea that he still sat there with his hands in his pockets whilst this bloke's bleeding to death.
Charlie, what would have got him out of his seat?
Yeah, Charlie, what would you do in this scenario?
The reality is it does depend on game state a little bit. Depends how big a game it was. I'll be honest there. If it was petering out or as a game my team was losing, maybe I'd be more chivalrous. But if I really wanted to stay, it might be one where you have to say, I'm really sorry it's happened, but ultimately I'm not going to help. You're with the professionals now.
Yeah.
Best of luck.
Good luck. Yeah, best of luck. Yeah.
All the best for the season.
Final one on this, and I don't want to get too Barry Davis about this, but it's something nobody likes to see. Damon Shaw, we stole a ball from Manchester United versus Anderlecht in around 2000. I put it under my hoodie and walked out with it after the game. Ralph, I'm not happy about this at all, but it does make me wonder. Every time the ball goes into the stand on telly, and I think, where is it? Is it going to come back? Where's that ball gone? A match ball must be just the most disproportionately prized possession for someone.
Yeah, I mean, to be able to get it out of the ground, I suppose it's got to be a pretty big crowd to be able to hide somebody with a
cheap. They're not cheap, these balls.
No. So yeah, that's pretty impressive stuff to get a match ball out of the ground.
That would feel like a proper heist, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I bet they were walking in groups with the guy in the middle. And
yeah,
he couldn't have pulled that off on his own. There's going to be guys.
Well, you need accomplices.
Well, I think he's got guys distracted security. He's got guys asking questions just as they're
people creating diversions.
Yeah, I think he's really worked on this whole.
I reckon that's harder to do now. I feel like now everything's so strict, and whenever a ball's there, it seems like there are ball boys and whoever really getting at you and stewards to chuck it back.
What was the security like at Giant Axe in 1989?
I don't remember a lot of it, to be honest.
Right.
Sure enough, if I'd have wanted to, I could have taken it, but the rest of the crowd would, all of the rest of the 59 people would have just looked at me like I was inside.
You could have been a proud owner of a mitre.
Yeah.
Delta. It would have been the only match ball probably back then Literally, the game would have been
probably had marker pen on it as well.
Farsley Celtic FC on it. That would have been poor form. Your career would have been in ruins. Tell us about your third love of football. Enjoy this one.
I just love a Burger Van cheeseburger on the way to a game. It's the kind of thing that I just wouldn't put anywhere near my mouth or my stomach in 99% of situations. But there's just something about the excitement of going to the game, having a few pints of fizzy lager before, or on the way to the game, it just turns that weird kind of sweaty almost burger thing. It's of undeterminate meat as well. I've got no idea what the meat is. The cheese is properly rubbery and is never. It's a long way from a cow. And so, yeah, it just turns into the food of the gods in that particular situation. So, yeah.
Before we examine this in any particularly footballing context, the way you've described it, it makes me realise that it's a very specific form of hunger, the kind of two or three pint hunger when you're on the way to something.
It's the cousin of a late night kebab, that pre-game cheeseburger. When you've had a few drinks and you're so, so hungry. And that cheeseburger is incredible. You're describing the onions for me elevate it as well. That smell of onions as they kind of waft towards you, and you're right, it is legitimized by the fact that it's before a football game. And you're right, if you ate that, and it's like a kebab, if you ate that or a kebab for a lunch, of a Tuesday afternoon, you'd be like, what am I doing with my life?
The fundamental
it's totally
difference.
Legit there.
The fundamental difference between a kebab, Ralph, and the burger of which you speak is that the thing about these burgers on the way is that they're almost less than zero texture. You just go straight through it. Yeah, there is absolutely nothing there.
Yeah,
it's incredible.
It, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of oniony, salty cotton wool that just kind of goes in and just absorbs some of the lager you just took down your throat.
It got me thinking about the kind of the evolution of match day food. Burgers and pies were, of course, you know, beyond cliche, perhaps. Mm. And then, Charlie, of course, we got onto popcorn and filled nachos, which is, you know, very troublesome games gone territory. And, of course, last month we had the highly controversial man with whole homemade Victoria sponge at Craven Cottage, which was so far from the mushy burger. It's possible to get, I think.
The carrot battens. I mean, the evolution has been huge. There's definitely a long read in this.
Yeah.
The evolution of football food. And also the resistance to change, I guess. Because there are a lot of people who would think that those are sacrosanct.
Mm.
And I wonder actually how much their sales have been hit. I feel like it's such a loyal market. It is such a staple, certainly for people who've been going to football for enough of a time. Maybe not for, hard to attract new audiences.
It must be the most solid habit of all. You would have the same burger every, and then you add superstition to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And then it would just become, and that's what sustains this tiny industry, I think. It's just people just having to do the same thing before a game. But burgers, Ralph, ergonomic, like it all makes sense. Like even inside a stadium, it kind of makes sense. You can eat it with one hand.
Yeah.
It takes probably about, I don't know, 3 minutes max.
Pies.
I'm going to look like a massively naive armchair football fan here, but I just, I can't really understand the enduring appeal of the pie as a football going food. It doesn't feel like very practical to me at all.
No, I mean, it's all to do with texture, isn't it? And to do with the way they tend to heat the insides of those pies to temperature of molten lava. So you have to hold them in your hand for about 10 minutes before you can even start to get involved with the stuff in the middle. So that, I think that's generally the problem. If they were the right temperature, they'd probably be a decent, like a burger, they'd probably be eaten like that, but life in your own hands by eating one straight away.
Anything where you get given a small fork, I'm almost thinking like this.
Rubbish.
It feels like too much work. It's just not going to, it's never going to work. It's too much hassle.
If I wanted cutlery, I would have, gone to an actual restaurant. But still, pies persist. And as Jamie Thompson points out, he says, I love the idea that so many football fans could tell you the away ground at which they had the best and worst pie, to the extent that those clubs then wear it as a badge of honour. It does become something of a bragging point for certain sort of lower league clubs. And it's always the Balti pie as well. It's always the Balti one that gets voted the best one in the country. Why can't anything rival this? This is the monopoly that no one ever talks about. This is the Balti pie.
The famous Balti pie of insert lower league.
Well,
club.
I mean, just to prove this point, Darren Leithley says the best food I've ever had was at Millmore. A chicken Balti pie that staved off the cold and frustration of a Leeds defeat live on Sky one Monday in November 2004. You must have been there, Ralph.
I don't think I was, but I was probably feeling the same pain.
Barney Hunter, this story takes something of a twist. He says, the best food by far, and not just because I support them, is Norm's Goat Curry at Luton Town. Sounds great, which is unfortunate because I'm vegetarian now. Can't be that good, Barney. Can't be that good, is all I'm saying. Good food, very much part of the tapestry of match-going fans' experience. But I'm more interested in bad matchday food because I just feel like that's far funnier. Mm. Charlie, there isn't a season of EFL football that's complete without at least one unimpressed photo of some cheesy chips, which is just chips with a slice of American cheese on the top that has not melted. I feel like that is absolutely obligatory for an EFL season.
Yeah, that's good eating. But the thing is, with all of these things, anything that you can have, I feel, again, that's more a kind of late night kebab, cheesy chips. Whereas I just want the purity of that cheeseburger, because I do feel that's so exclusive to football grounds.
Mm. Interesting one for you here, Ralph. Tom Woodhead. You may be familiar with this, I don't know. He says, I present to you Ellen Road's famous Meal Deal 1. Do you know about this?
No.
Okay, let me just give you a snapshot of the... This is on the stadium concourse in the bowels of Elland Road itself. Does Elland Road have bowels? Yeah, is it Bowley Stadium?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. The magnificent new East Stand, as we still call it, even though it was built in 2000. That's quite Bowley.
Here's a non-exhaustive list of the items available. Meat and potato pie, £3.10. Chicken balti pie, £3.10. Cheese and onion pie, £3.10. Peppered steak pie, £3.10. Burger, £3.70. Cheeseburger, £3.90. Interesting selection. But if you're feeling a little bit more adventurous, there's Meal Deal 1, which is pint and crisps.
Oh, that's brilliant.
£4.50. Good deal.
You'll do. Excellent.
Point of Chris.
That's lunch.
Tom Woodhead rounds this off by saying, there is no meal deal two. Things are about to take a turn for the surreal, however. Johnny Sharples has alerted me to a worrying development in the Northwest Counties Football League, where Bursko FC offer you a pea dog. Ralph, this is mushy peas in a hot dog roll.
Oh, God.
I mean, it's the texture you're after. I mean, it's exactly the same texture.
Oh, it's not, though, is it? Through that. But that's just slop, isn't it? That's just going to go out of each end. It's going to go all over your hands. It's,
you get a cup of peas on the side as well, just in case you need to top it up.
You need
a side of peas.
No, you need considerably. I mean, like, you can have mushy peas on a pie.
Yeah,
but not on a hot dog roll. No,
only our podcast listeners could see the face of Ralph Ineson right now as I offered the words pea dog. Never seen someone so disgusted. I might be able to beat that though, Charlie, because Todd Wilde goes all the way back to 2002, and he says, "I once saw some Beyondegi silkworm pupae sold from a vendor outside the World Cup stadium in Seoul. Needless to say, I passed and had the hot dog on a stick instead." Would you ever, what state of footballing excitement or anticipation, Charlie, would you need to be in for silkworm pupae?
Or almost just in a, either exhilaration where I'm like, fuck it, I'll do it, or I'm just so despairing, I'm like, well, whatever, I'm at rock bottom, this can't get any worse, I'll do it.
This could be meal deal too, Ralph.
Yeah, silkworm pupae.
Chardonnay and silkworm pupae. A fantastic start to Mezahala Discs. As I said, really life-affirming.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Oh, look at that! That is wonderful!
Brought to your ears by The Athletic. This is Football Clichés.
Welcome back to Football Clichés. This is Mezzet Harland Dix, Ralph Ineson. And he's talked us through his loves of football, mostly food-related. Let's get stuck into your hates, please, Ralph.
First one, anticlimactic corners. The fact that 90% of corners just seem to end up as nothing when there's so much excitement and build-up to them. At Leeds, particularly, there's the chant of comes up whenever we get a corner, which gets the whole ground up. And nothing ever happens. And particularly annoying are short corners, specifically the ones that end up in offside straight away. Just like, why would you do that? Also, ones that don't beat the first man, don't beat the first defender, so just get nodded away at the edge of the six-yard box. There's got to be something about corners or something to be done about corners, because they never or so rarely fulfil the promise they have.
Oh, no. Before we get stuck into the corners themselves, which I'm very interested in, I want to talk about the anticipation for a first or second corner. If you get two in succession, it's, off the scale. But Charlie, Ralph is right. I never thought about this before, but there are very specific chants that fans will do at that stage. And it's hard to describe them because they don't fit general play. They're too urgent, aren't they? They're too self-contained for the ball being passed around in midfield. So there are some chants that just sort of lend themselves to, okay, we have a set piece.
Some teams will even put on the those things around the side or on a big screen with the like corner chant, you know, the equivalent of Leeds, 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 because it's so specific. It's such a specific thing. I mean, corner, but you touched on something there, Ralph. I think it was in Moneyball where they talk about the fact that in England there's this disproportionate weight is given to corners, despite the fact the numbers show that they are really not that a productive way of scoring. And one club had to educate the players that, because, you know, there's that thing where players will often get a big cheer if they kind of shepherd the ball off to win a corner and then sort of rouse the crowd. And it's like, come on, we've won a corner. And actually, one team had to tell their players, like, stop doing that. You're far more likely in most cases to score from whipping in a cross if you've got a couple of men in the box than a corner where everyone's set. And the near post thing, that was, I mean, Christian Eriksen at Spurs, that was genuinely like a huge issue between him and the fan base. His habit of hitting the near post. And then there were the defenders of him saying, no, he has to do that because that's where most goals are scored from corners. You don't get it. He's doing it for this reason. And it became a sort of culture war, the Christian Eriksen near post corners.
But I want to kind of offer a counterpoint to this because, okay, the numbers don't back it up. That's established. I mean, and the eye test, you know, it's this enduring frustration about, you know, general corner scenes. But if you took out the corner anticipation, what are you really left with as a match-going football fan, Ralph? I mean, that's probably, what, 27% of your match day emotion just taken away from you? The anticipation of a corner, maybe even a second one.
Oh, did you see? It's revelations like these which are just questioning my whole whole being.
So it's fine to be excited is what I'm saying. It's fine.
Right, yeah, yeah.
It's the hope and dreams, after all, condensed into one kick of a ball.
Yeah, I suppose I do. I do enjoy the anticipation, and that's why I hate the repeated disappointment because I constantly fall for it. I constantly get excited, and like you say, then if you get another one, you suddenly become extra excited, and in your brain, you're kind of thinking, "Well, obviously, it didn't happen last time, so it makes it even more likely that we're going to score off this one because they can't possibly defend two corners on the trot. That's mathematically impossible. Your excitement level is going up and up and up." For absolutely no reason, you know, for the keeper to catch it and just roll it out to the winger.
And the second corner will never be the same as the first one. They'll never try the same thing. So by definition, they'll pick that lock. Okay, so we've got the anticipation out of the way, Charlie. I feel like we need to establish the official hierarchy of irritating corners. What's kind of an entry level, you know, should have done better there? Is it overhit, maybe?
Yeah, there are a couple. I mean, one is, if you've piled it in, you've piled the big men into the box, and then it sails over everyone's head, and then the centre-backs look at them like, what have I come up for if you're going to do that?
You're Ralph Ineson's trotting up.
Yeah, exactly. Those accomplished.
Looking really purposeful, standing on the edge, like ready to go.
Ralph looking from side to side in that way centre-backs do, as, you know, I'm showing leadership here. That's non-forgivable. Those ones that just sail into the keeper's arms, that are kind of floated, and you're like, what's anyone going to do with that? Yeah, the near post one. I mean, obviously, the kind of gold standard for particularly bad, there's that Aspas one, isn't there, for Liverpool?
Oh, yeah.
He took a corner so badly. It was when they were chasing that game in the Denver Bar goal, exactly, and then Liverpool broke his goal. And that is his epitaph, basically. That's all he's remembered for at Liverpool, is that shite corner. It can really affect a player's career.
But let's nail this down. Ralph, a simple question for you. Is overhit corners better than an underhit corner? Which one just annoys you less, basically?
I think an overhit one.
Because it's like, at least he's wellied it. Basically what we're saying?
Yeah, at least it just... Yeah, there's something really irritating about the underhit one because nothing has a chance to develop. If you overhit it, you think, well, at least people have got near the business end of it. Maybe somebody will be able to loop round and pick it up and cross it back in. If it just goes bang straight into the man at the near post, that's more irritating, I think.
Completely agree. So short corners then. Now, Charlie, I've softened the short corner. I've softened to it over the years. I've softened to many things over the years, but short corners just don't bother me. I get it now. I understand why it happens. There's so much prep that goes behind it. But the scenario that Ralph put forward, the short corner leading to an immediate offside, is one of the most inexcusable things in football. Yeah.
That is unforgivable. That's totally unforgivable. And I agree with you. I've been on a similar journey from in my younger days, just being, in my head, I was like blanket ban on short corners. I can see why sometimes they're used. That said, I do still maintain, and this is a very like me age 10 thing, which I probably heard from Andy Gray or someone, was a team has a corner, puts it in and causes havoc, and the team's clearly really struggling to deal with it. It's got a goalkeeper who doesn't seem to particularly enjoy coming for crosses, and then the next one you take a short one. I still find that then I'm still like the 10-year-old me is like, just put it in. He clearly hates it.
Can you imagine Ralph's head would explode if that happened? Two short corners in a row. But it's
thinking about it in light of what you were generally talking about the productivity of corners and lack of a traditional corner, then maybe I am doing the short corner down a bit, because if actually winging it in obviously produces so little, why not just try and pass it around the edge and beat a man?
Especially if you're a team like, I remember the sort of Pep's Barcelona would do that, would take a short corner, and you kind of think, well, fair enough, they're probably more likely to do something with Iniesta one-on-one with a defender on the edge of the box than by launching it into a bunch of like 5-for-8 attack.
Yeah, I mean, such an extreme example that I literally couldn't imagine that team sort of taking a regular corner and be like, well, what are you doing? That's wrong. That's not going to work. You're going to give it away. So, maybe we are all closet possession hoggers after all. But it's felt like therapy for you, Ralph, this one.
Yeah, I think I've made some progress. I really did.
Good, glad to hear it. Tell us about your second hatred, or at least minor irritation, of football.
Oh, yes. And also, since I told you this one, I've also realised some things about it. So,
go for it. All yours.
Old immobile goalkeepers.
Right.
And I've realised, actually, that this is probably quite an out-of-date hatred that I've carried for years and years because of two particular examples. I mean, in the old days when I was on, before they changed the back pass rule stuff, keepers didn't have to be particularly mobile, and the fact that they had a huge physical presence and strength and this extra experience was always kind of prized. And this whole idea of, keepers, didn't age like outfield players. They could play on longer, and it was actually encouraged, and they became these wise gurus of the penalty box once they got into their late 30s. Even though, obviously, nature dictates that you're going to be able to move your frame around slower and less springily when you get to that. So the two incidents I'm referring to, obviously, are Peter Shilton in the semi-final of the 1990 World Cup. It's clambering backwards. Flailing for this thing. I mean, Chris Woods, who sat on the bench, would have walked backwards and caught it to him. And then the same with Seaman in 2002 and Ronaldinho. That kind of thing is that suddenly, though there was such big moments, just to show that particular annoying superstition we seemed to have at the time. Because at that point, Nigel Martin was on the bench and should have played instead of Seaman for the last few years of Seaman's international career, in my opinion. I mean,
I would say you're that. You're leading United fans' opinion.
But he was fantastic at that time, Nigel Martin. I think that he should have played longer for England and would have been in goal at that point. And I think, again, would have walked backwards and caught that 200. Old immobile goalkeepers was a pet hate, and I've realised since I told you the other day that it's a very out of date pet hate.
That's fine.
Because keepers are much younger, and that is accepted now. The athleticism of keepers, and also the need to be able to be much better athletes and footballers to be able to play the ball when they didn't used to, when they could just pick the ball up from a back pass.
Do you find that gratifying? You've been proved right after all these years.
Yeah, I think I do, actually. Yeah.
Your relentless lobbying has really caused meaningful change.
Yes, I think so.
I don't mind that this is a kind of a retrospective thing, because, I mean, the Shilton thing in particular, it's such a well-documented kind of retrospective gripe. Like, people genuinely are annoyed looking back that he was anywhere near that penalty shootout, for example. I mean, we won't go into the Dave Besson super myth either, because this podcast is not the place. But maybe at the time, I've never heard from anyone at the time who was annoyed by it. So I feel like, extra layers of watching athletic 20-something goalkeepers flinging themselves around Charlie makes us look back now and just think, what were we doing?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. And I do think there was something, you're right, Ralph, that keepers, older keepers, were given this sort of protected status where it was like, they may not be able to move so well anymore, but they're so experienced and, you know, you need that as a goalkeeper. So we'll let them keep playing until they're clearly way past their best.
I'm starting to wonder if there's an element of conspiracy here propagated by the goalkeepers union, Ralph, because this idea that goalkeepers peak later is, you know, demonstrably true, but also at the same time feels like a myth perpetuated by big goalkeeper just to keep everyone in business. Because I mean, there are only so many jobs for an ex-goalkeeper.
Yeah. they've got to get some kind of niche, because it's got to be kind of like the shittest job, really, of being a goalkeeper. So yeah, to mystify it somehow, I think is important. I mean, you've got Albert Camus, obviously, as your patron saint of keeping goalkeepers cool. But there's not a lot beyond that.
I mean, he famously didn't peak until he was, God knows. when was L'Etranger? I don't remember. But Charlie, I mean, but they're so put upon, goalkeepers, in this particular context. You know, age really does go against them, because the hurdles they've had to face over the last 30 years or so, as Ralph said, the back pass law, which kind of eliminated an entire generation of goalkeepers who just couldn't.
And centre halves as well.
Well, yes.
Yeah, he suddenly went, what do you mean I can't just get out of the situation by knocking it back to my keeper? You mean I've got to play the ball?
Give it another 25, 30 years, and like kids will be looking back going, what? This is insane. How could this possibly have been allowed to happen? Being a goalkeeper looks really easy. So that the sort of back pass law was the real kind of turning point for all this. And then sort of in latter years, Charlie, kind of high lines and pressing came in. So goalkeepers had so much more to deal with, so much space to potentially have to operate in, which must have just terrified the likes of, say, Peter Cech, for example, who looked suddenly really outdated despite being an incredibly good goalkeeper.
Yeah, well, check when Unai Emery took over at Arsenal and got them to play out the back, and it was really uncomfortable to watch. But yeah, that's an interesting point about whether keepers now, the fact that they do have to be so much more athletic, they probably actually cover a reasonable amount of ground per game in a way that they never used to. So yeah, the days perhaps of the 40-plus-year-old keeper maybe on the line.
I hope not. There's something about a 40-year-old
goalkeeper very novelty.
Makes me feel safe, Ralph. Yeah. There is still that element of that experience that makes you think, we're going to be fine. He knows what to do.
As has been proved, he's just slower and a bit fatter, generally.
Absolutely. But, of course, this did get me thinking, like, peak age is this kind of sort of truism, Charlie, across the board for various positions that people sort of just think they know but can't really back up with data. So I asked our listeners what they thought the peak ages were for the various positions on the pitch.
Ooh, interesting.
In fact, Tom Guerriero Davis has nailed this right down. He offers two criteria straight away. He says legs, which consists of pace/fitness, and head, which consists of experience/positional sense. So those are the two kind of driving forces here. Goalkeepers, 34. Negligible legs required. So 34 seems about right. If I had a 34-year-old goalkeeper now, I'd say, yeah, bang on. That seems fine.
Maybe a bit younger.
Yeah.
I reckon maybe a little bit younger than that.
Okay.
I'd agree. I'd knock it at least a couple of years off that.
32. We're going for 32.
Like that
does make you feel safe. Yeah, I think that is the right... I mean, yeah, any self-respecting 32-year-old athlete should be fine in the agility stakes. Fullbacks, this is where he gets really into the detail. He says 26 years old. It's 60-40 in terms of legs versus head. Don't know, because, I mean, Ross FJ says right backs seem to last longer than left backs. He thinks left backs 24, right backs 27. Who are these people?
Just super random.
Ages.
Yeah, I think that's changed as well, though, because I think back in the day, you did want your fullbacks to be those sort of veterans who just seem to be very, like, a safe pair of hands. Whereas now, in the age of them actually, like, running as much as anyone, I think you probably do want a bit younger.
His logic kind of starts to unravel as he goes through the team. Defensive midfield, 30, legs useful, head is vital. Wingers, 24, optimum legs required. And then striker, 29, just feels right.
You can't go through with all your special metrics.
Run out of steam there.
And go, oh, job, but whatever, that feels about right.
Absolutely no stamina whatsoever. No. More alarmingly, Will Tucker thinks goalkeepers peak at the age of 28, Ralph.
Ooh.
Well, you see, it depends, you know, if you're looking at this all action, high press, working as a sweeper, doing all this kind of stuff, maybe it's the same.
And Leeds have a very young keeper, don't they?
He's fantastic, like Mario.
The youngest Premier League goalkeeper, youngest looking Premier League goalkeeper I've ever seen.
Have you ever heard him speak?
No. Has he got a voice like yours or something?
Honestly, yeah, he's as deep as me. Genuinely.
Really?
Genuinely. He is phone to me, dogs like this. My name is Ilya Milia.
I don't want to hear it. Genuinely.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying because obviously he looks like a 15-year-old boy.
Yeah, he does.
But yeah, he sounds like me.
Wow. Wow, interesting. I'll investigate.
Fantastic keeper.
Josh Dickens, Charlie, muddies the waters completely here, undermining everything we've spoken about. He says, is any player ever at peak age? Peak is always approaching 2 or 3 years down the line, or arguably in the past, or not quite at the level when he was at his peak. It's always declared in the future or in the past. I mean, a player is never at his peak.
That's a really good point, actually. Yeah, when you talk about, you know, and he'll be approaching his peak in 2 to 3 years when you talk about like contract negotiations and things like that.
But, you know, from a linguistic perspective, there are some caveats here. Ralph, I sort of agree with this. I wouldn't accept someone declaring a player being at his peak, but I would accept someone saying a player is at the peak of his powers.
Oh, peak of your powers. Definitely. Yeah.
Are you at the peak of your powers? I mean, you have about 58 films coming out in 2021/2022.
I'm busy, but I don't think of my powers. Hopefully. You see, this is the thing. It's all about head if you're a character actor. You don't have to have legs for the
match. It's all up there.
Yeah. It's not like I've got looks to lose. So I'm hoping my career is going to just carry on rundling along like some goalkeeper who's...
Like a Teddy Sheringham, your first few yards are up there.
Yeah, absolutely.
Looking forward to you finally winning the Oscar for your portrayal of a recently retired former centre-half who's fallen on hard times. Because I'm sticking with it. If someone doesn't direct it, I will. So it's going to happen. But you know, staying down this track, so peak of his powers is fine, but Charlie, does it mean the same thing as in his pomp? Peak of powers, pomp, same things?
I don't know. It feels like there is a subtle difference.
Why?
Well, in his pomp...
You can't say...
I feel like you'd always say that retrospectively.
Yeah, exactly.
Whereas peak of your powers, you can say like... And we're talking about a player who's at the peak of his powers.
That's fine. So, Ralph, you can't have a current pomp. You can't...
I don't think you can say he's in his pomp. You can say when he was in his pomp. But I don't think you can currently be in your pomp.
Yeah, I think you're right. What follows is I think, Charlie, my favourite bullet point I've ever written on the Football Clichés running order, which is, can a goalkeeper have a pomp? No one's ever... Literally, I reckon I would... Of all the things we've ever spoken about in this podcast, I reckon no one on this planet, dead or alive, has ever asked this question. Can a goalkeeper have a pomp?
When he was in his pomp...
I think you've got to entertain, haven't you? It's even hard for a journeyman
footballer, a
fairly boring footballer, to be in that pomp. I think they've got to be an entertainer of some kind, haven't they?
Yeah, let's find out the dictionary definition of pomp.
Makes it hard for a goalkeeper to be in that pomp.
I'm just trying to think who's the most like pomp Premier League player. I mean, like Eric Cantona, I'm thinking. He was in his pomp.
Yeah, pomp literally means ceremony. Literally. Splendid display. Vain and ostentatious. It is pure Cantona, isn't it?
Very Cantona.
Cantona is officially the pompiest footballer in Premier League history, but no goalkeepers allowed in pomp land.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
We've been building up to this one. It's all been vaguely proper football man so far. Do you know what, Ralph? I think very traditional footballing values here, and I'm really interested in your third hatred of football. This is where you're really going to let loose, I sense.
My third hatred is biased co-commentators. And I just don't really understand the logic behind. I also, it irritates me as well, ex-players maintaining this ludicrous kind of rivalries to kind of, you know, appeal to the fans of the clubs they used to play for or whatever, to constantly be doing down other teams because that club dislikes that club. And I just think it's a really boring element to the co-commentator's game.
Come on, name names. Tell us what you're
my particular hatred.
Who's upset you this time?
Who hurt me this time? Well, it's all right now. I've got over it. But for about 3 years, the last 3 years, Leeds were in the Championship. The Sky's coverage of the EFL with the co-commentators that they had meant that I don't think I watched a game with commentary for about 3 years.
Oh my God, it was that deep.
Yeah, just put music on. And just went, what's the players? We didn't have anything on. And the biggest offenders were Don Goodman and Keith Andrews. They just had such a whiny, pathetic anti-Leeds goal all the time. I just have to turn it on. Yeah. So that's that kind of overly connected to clubs that they weren't even great players for anyway. You know what I mean?
Right. Okay, so many angles to approach this from. But first of all, let's face it, this is a very Leeds thing, isn't it? Leeds are kind of disproportionately hated or look like they are hated by so many clubs, you know, nearby or otherwise. This feels like a particularly Leeds obsession, I would say.
Yeah, I think you're probably right, because a big part of your existence of being a Leeds fan is dealing with the fact that, you know, it's not normal. You can turn around and people say, oh, you just put, say, oh, West Ham, all right, yeah, I'm like, trying to rook it, whatever. Hello, the county as well. You know, they'll talk like that. But, you know, when you say you're a Leeds fan, it gets a reaction every time. Everybody, whoever they support.
Instinctive, almost illogical.
Yeah, which, you know, makes the club box office in the sense that people will always watch Leeds on telly because they'll want whoever they're playing to win. Now, that kind of thing. It's a bit like, you know, the Man United thing as well. It's that kind of hatred. So yeah, the constant hitting on it is you get all the time, and it just gets very annoying when it gets into the realm of the commentators. It's like, I don't want to hear that. I get it from other fans all the time. I live in London in the Chelsea area. I just get abuse for being a Leeds fan all the time. I've done for the last 30 years of living it. I don't need it when I turn the TV on and listen to the commentary. I don't need Don
Goodman.
You've
been surrounded by Don Goodman as you walk down the King's Road or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Before we get stuck into the real kind of psychology of this, one thing I have noticed, I don't know if this will change your mind straight away. I suspect it might not. Do you know what Don Goodman's middle name is? It's Ralph.
Ooh.
Don Goodman's middle name is Ralph. Look, see? Everything's fine. You're both basically Ralphs. He might even have a dog called, I don't know, Ian Hart or something.
Oh, is that really supposed to change my mind? I think I'm secretly a Southampton fan as well.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, let's talk about this. Because I'm not saying I'm above it by any stretch of the imagination. Charlie, we've all been afflicted by this, imagine, on some level or other. But I'm fascinated by the concept of bias, especially when it comes to co-commentators on TV and why it affects the enjoyment and the engagement of a person watching. What is it about? Because, I mean, it's just words being spoken by someone. It's not going to affect the game itself, although it feels like it does.
I think what I find most irritating is not even when it seems like a commentator dislikes my team. It's when it seems like a commentator is spouting stuff about my team that was a cliche 5 to 10 years ago and clearly has done so little watching of my team or research that they're happy to just chuck out these tropes that are just no longer really accurate. I find that more irritating. And that's where you get the lazy commentary, lazy punditry sort of thing. And I know people think that's a bit righteous and whatever, but it is really, really annoying. And so if you've got a commentator, and I don't know what Don Goodman's particular offence was, but if he's saying, you know, just lazy stuff, that's...
That was kind of my thing. It's exactly that. It's referring back to those things like the burnout, the Bielsa burnout.
Yeah, I was going to mention
that cliche. That really isn't true. but, you know, they'd be trooping that out, you know, every time when they, you know, they... we kind of had a quiet 20 minutes in the second half.
Oh,
my God, they're burning out again.
It would be more subtle than that, though. It'd be even more subtle than that. Look tired, Leeds. Tired for me.
Looking a bit leggy.
We've seen this before. Is that an issue for them? We know it's affecting the Elsa teams.
No, I mean, I can feel the kind of, by proxy, I can feel the frustration here. But it does eat away at you. I felt it too. Don't worry. You know, I've had Tony Gale commentate on an illegal stream for my team before. I know what it feels like. But it comes at such a bad time, doesn't it, Ralph? Because you're already paranoid and tormented by the game in front of you.
Yeah.
As any self-respecting football fan but should be, you're never confident of what's going to happen.
No.
So when someone is basically employed to, deliberately or otherwise, cast doubt over your team's chances at that time or in the bigger picture, it's going to eat away at you.
Yeah, it is. It's just like someone stabbing you in the back with a little sharp stick whilst you're watching the game. It's like, fuck off. Really?
Is that?
Which is stupid, ill-informed comments that don't mean anything. And just because Leeds let you go, Tom Goodman, just don't bring it back.
The thing as well is you start then looking out, you're waiting for it. And the anticipation's almost as bad. Yeah. You're like, oh, God, it's coming, isn't it? It's coming. It's going to be
I'll ask him another Leeds question. Oh, you've asked him it. There we go.
Yeah, exactly. Please, no.
I mean, there are so many angles here. It afflicts pretty much everyone. I can see why it would afflict a Leeds fan more, given the historical and current kind of sort of rumblings that people will always kind of pick up on, especially if they're being particularly lazy. Yeah.
Doing the Leeds.
Yeah, of course, all that stuff. The style of co-commentary, Charlie, in the last five years or so, it's kind of, we've moved on from kind of the emphatic Scotsman who just enjoyed great goals and bold attacking play and heavy tackles and stuff and enjoyed the spectacle for what it was. And for better or worse, we now have quite earnest co-commentators who kind of want to show that they're in touch with the modern game and how things work. And it kind of lends itself more to casting doubt over your team's performance. So it's only going to go one way, isn't it? People are going to get more and more annoyed.
True, although touching on Tony Gale is significant there, because I do find if I do ever have to watch on a stream, and so you get, maybe not your elite commentators, you are reminded a little bit of the kind of how commentary was a few years ago. And I do think it was worse then, because you don't have the same earnestness, but you do have the same, I'm going to say something that's fairly vague and was once relevant about this team, and in the hope that it's still correct close enough, rather than now I feel, you know, the standards have been raised.
I think, strange for a Leeds fan to say it, but I think Gary Neville has got a lot of credit for that. He came into punditry. I think he made a lot of them up their game, because he suddenly started talking in simple terms about exactly how formations worked. In layman's terms, he explained the stuff that, co-commentators in the past would just, wouldn't even bother trying to explain. And I think that he changed it. And so the co-commentator's job is to now, seems to be, when it's done well, and I don't think Sky's EFL coverage was done well, but when it is done well nowadays, I think the commentator commentates and the co-commentator gives a professional insight. A professional footballers, playing someone who has played professional football and has been coached in these formations, these systems, and so then can put that into layman's terms. I think that's now the job of the co-commentator, whereas before, like you say, it used to be just to get excited about goals and throw in a bit of old club rivalry every now and then.
Okay, so let's recap what we've covered here, because I feel like we've peered into your footballing soul, and so much has poured out as a result. The joy and cruelty of nutmegs. Great fun. Touching the match ball, which I think we've all enjoyed to various degrees. And a great shout out to the Giant Axe Stadium, something I'd never heard of before. The plasticine textured Burger Van cheeseburgers, pre-match, importantly, not post-match. The anticlimactic nature of 99% of corners. The myth perpetuated by the Goalkeepers Union that old goalkeepers are still of any use whatsoever. And finally, Don Goodman. Don Ralph Goodman.
Oh, I'm going to walk into him in some VIP lounge at Ellen Road after a game when he's been commentating or something.
Some after-dinner event.
Another Legends game.
Yeah. Yeah. He's going to go straight through you.
He's going to do a Roy Keane
outfit. We're standing don't, over me.
Don't stand
me.
Over me talking yeah. about Bias Go commentary. Good luck with your 58 films next year.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. My goodness.
I saw the ball there, I think.
I saw the BAFTA there, I think. It's like that, yeah. Exactly. Anyway, but yeah, no, yeah, despite the huge Proper Football Man vibes, which I actually thoroughly enjoyed, no, I feel like it was a well-rounded selection. Thank you, Ralph. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate your time.
It was fun.
Yeah, cheers. Charlie, thanks very much again.
Thank you. That was great fun.
And huge revelation to come on the next episode of Clichés. Hope you can make it. And see everyone next week. Bye.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.